He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans for nobody. Doesn't have a point of view, knows not where he's going to. Isn't he a bit like you?
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. Or as we're now calling it now. What the hell?
Yes. It is as it is, we say.
Rather be watching Daredevil Cast is what we're going to call it from now on. Anything we're doing, we would rather be watching Daredevil. I am Andrew Farmer, as always. With me is my co-host, producer, the Jedi Cole Houston.
I'm actually changing my name to Daredevil Cole.
Are you?
Or actually, to be more accurate, because I don't want people to imagine for a second that I'm going to do any backflips or crap. Rather be watching Daredevil Cole.
You can be the Foggy Nelson. I'll be the Daredevil. You can be Foggy.
The thing is that Foggy on that show, they have made Foggy a pretty hip character.
They really have. And
in the comics, I'd come and punch you.
Right. But that's why it's acceptable now to be Foggy.
Want to be the Foggy.
And we're dating this episode so hard, by the way.
If you stumble on this on, you know, some strange holocron.
The holocron, right.
You can think, wow, that's when that Netflix was relevant.
But here's the thing about Foggy number one. Number one, he has the best wardrobe in any show I've seen in a really long time. Like he's killing it. Like, way to go, Foggy. Number two, they kind of sexied up Foggy a little bit.
And they did. They give him the Eugene from, in a more civilized world, that's what Eugene from Walking Dead would look like.
And they toughened him up some in some of the later episodes. Like, all right, way to go. He's
actually more like somebody who would live in Hell's Kitchen.
Right.
It's somebody who would be terrified to live in, part of a retirement community.
Branson, Missouri.
Dangerous.
I really like, there are two characters that they've changed from the comics that I'm wholehearted invested in. One of them is Foggy. They've done a really good job with him, and the other one is Ben Urich. They've really wired him in this show, so good on them for that. I don't know if you've gotten there yet, Cole.
I'm not there. I'm not as far along as you are. Late arriving, and I have to say that the thing I applaud more than anything is that Netflix isn't pretending to be a network.
Right.
They're not like, oh, this is Netflix, you can dial up any time, but you have to wait a week to get the next Daredevil.
Right. They're like, we know you. We know our audience.
I tell you what, why don't you binge watch the hell out of things on here? There you go. Binge watch.
Right.
And now.
2 a.m. Start.
Yeah.
But there was a really good... The Daredevil comic that always cracked me up, and I know that this isn't going to happen, but I really wish it would, since we're about to get the Avengers Age of Ultron book, was when Daredevil's hanging out with the Fantastic Four and the Inhumans, and there was a damaged Ultron. And this all ties into the shows that we're recording tonight, because not only is Ultron a fantastic robot in his own right, but the book is super obscure. So Daredevil manages to take out Ultron.
Wow. Nice.
Yeah, part and parcel, single-handedly, with a baton to the face. So,
speaking of a baton to the face, because that's what this show has been. It has been such a baton to the face that I'm going to go right here right now as producer and say right now we're doing a super special.
Are we going to do a Daredevil
super special number one, a baton to the face.
A baton to the face.
You heard it right here.
And speaking of batons to the face, this show is going to be a baton to your face. We are all about awesome segues tonight. We have thrown seven awesome segues. It's like we have radar sense. I see this show as if it was a landscape on fire. Tonight's show is a show that Cole came up with, and he's going to be really, really steering the ship tonight because he's steeped in this and me not so much. I like, you know, Big Bang, Fight, Brian Michael Bendis talking heads. Cole's really steeped in this. And this is the house, the house of obscurity. Which we're going to talk about obscure comics tonight. Comics that you might not have heard of, comics that you should check out. And more importantly for me, where we used to go before, you know, what'd you call it, Cole?
Oh, in the before
times. In the before times, to find comic books.
This is the point where you need, like, a chorus of children going, the before times. Damn it, we need to hire a chorus of children.
Right, they frown on that.
You never know when you need them.
And you can't just keep them around.
Yeah, I don't have, like, a push, you know, like F6, the before time. I need to get some.
We just need to record that, yeah.
Yeah, and then you just, you know, program an F key, and I just hit that. Or even when I'm just by myself and I need the satisfying feeling of someone saying the before time.
Right, that would be great. But yes, so more importantly, for me, where we used to find comics, because you didn't used to have the internet and you know, all of your nerd friends on Facebook saying you should check out Bitch Planet because it's awesome, that didn't exist. So where would you like to take this? I'm handing the keys
to
you.
Yeah, we'll start there because in many ways what the House of Obscurity is about,
yes,
is the titles no one ever thinks of. These are the things you come across in the quarter bin, and you're cruising along, you're pulling your like your Micronauts and your your old Action Comics issues and stuff, and then all of a sudden you come across this thing. It's like, oh, here's like number three of this thing, and that was number one and two, that thing I found number three of, and you get kind of curious. Next thing you know, you got like six issues, you got maybe a couple issue gap, and you're like, what the hell, or a quarter. And you discover something you never thought about just by pure chance,
or that you never knew existed. Like it's insane. Like why you can't believe. I know for a fact that you know at conventions I would be flipping through. You know, it would be Sunday and there would be the giant liquidation sales, and I'd be flipping through and I'd be like, who in their right mind would have made this comic, let alone be selling it? So yeah. Yes.
And I'm trying to rack my brain because there were a couple of places that beyond just sort of stumbling on things. And I'll just start with an example. Catherine and I were at it was bizarre. It was like this restaurant that had a comic shop in the back. Like, we got some extra space. Let's
just
rent it out to a comic shop. And this tiny little comic shop, but I couldn't tell you where the hell we were. It was one of these places we were always going to go back. And then I think somebody told me they were gone. And that was true of so many places at that period. But it was like a bunch of long boxes in a tiny little space. And you just went back in there, and we were going nuts, and we hit upon a cache of this comic called The Serial Killings. And that serial is in, you know, Tony the Tiger. They're great type of serials.
Right.
And because I've just been dying to say, they're great for a while now. Or if you went to Alcon and saw the Groot Loop cereal, they're Groot! I'm punchy tonight.
Yeah, but it's going to be a good show.
A hell of a week. But the thing about it is, we found this Serial Killings by Jim Sturm, who would go on to make the amazing graphic novel The Golem's Mighty Swing, which I highly recommend. It is just a really good period piece. The Serial Killings was really neat because I kept, you know, it took a while to get like the one issue we were missing to track that down. It wasn't like something everybody had laying around because they probably never bought a copy for their shop.
Right.
But it was a little black and white indie. And what's fascinating about it is without even telling you what he was doing, the author gives you a world in which all of your favorite, you know, Tony the Tiger and Trix Rabbit and all that crap were real. It's like Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Nice.
Only like Who Framed Roger Rabbit, you're just, there you are. You are in this world. And for some reason, there's like regular guys, and then there's like a little elf that's running a cereal company that was founded by him and his two now dead brothers.
That's awesome.
I mean, what does this sound like? I don't know. It's not a ripoff, we swear. And you have the life and times of these characters. One of my favorite parts was Dougie, like Doug, the frog from some breakfast cereal. It was like sugar or whatever, some sugary breakfast cereal, and they talk about how, you know, he was just over the years became increasingly obese. And they're reminiscing after his funeral. Spoiler alert. But they're, you know, talking about apparently, like, what was brilliant is, you know, in his, they show like snippets in his commercials, he would be like heating up his cereals. Hey, how was them sugar, whatever? He goes, I dug them. D-O-U-G. And I'm like, oh my God, that is perfect. Just little winks like that.
Yeah.
And then they're talking about another little incident where I dug them. And, it's just really cool because you have, like, you know, characters that are clowns all the damn time.
Right.
So the guy's like getting up first thing in the morning. He's already a clown, you know? It's like, you know, so you get the impression that, like the rabbit or like the elephant guy or like the elf, they're just always like that. But yet there's normal guys too. And the principal character, you get the impression he's the grown up, one of the kids that had been press ganged into the crew of Captain Crunch's ship.
Yes. That is a great mental image that I just got.
Isn't it? I mean, if you think too much about your favorite breakfast cereals, there's some dark
1775, like on a dock somewhere. And
hey, kids, you like some cereal?
Pull the bag off all the kids' heads in order. They're all kneeled down on the gangplank.
You're on my ship now. How's everybody doing? We all remember what happened to Jim, don't we?
Just at the head of Jim. Just Captain Crunch holding the head of Jim.
Much like my cereal stays crispy in milk, Jim stayed crispy in that shark's mouth up until the last couple of seconds. And this
took a very dark turn.
Yeah.
Super dark.
Like probably listening to spitting crunch berries as we speak. I will never eat this cereal again. But it was one of these things where it was just a happy accident. Or, yeah, here it comes, Watchmen. Wow. So, you know, Watchmen comes out, and we're talking to a comic shop owner one time. He goes, oh, you like Alan Moore? And, you know, any good comic shop owner should always be doing this because they need to be like the guys that were running Suncoast back in the day. Right. Oh, your husband likes Jackie Chan movies? Let me unload these VHS tapes of movies he's in for 10 seconds.
You know, I was that guy. I worked at Suncoast.
Damn you!
In the Dayton Mall. I was that guy. Oh, you like...
guy. You were one of those guys.
Oh, no, I was pretty much... You know me well enough to know that if you came in,
no,
especially...
But you weren't the one that she encountered because we weren't in Dayton.
Especially if anybody said, like, Dolph Lundgren, I could name...
movies we can get rid of.
I could name every... And I was happy to get rid of them because if it was going to a good home, I was even happier. So I don't know how many copies of Red Scorpion I moved, but it was a lot.
Much like Red Scorpion here, we encountered we were able to help divest some long boxes of their issues of a book called Time Twisters.
Yeah.
Which was an Alan Moore anthology series. But unlike most anthology series, he wrote everything. So the anthology aspect was just different artists. And it was actually, you know, it's Alan Moore, so most of it was actually either good or incredible.
Right, right.
And oddly enough, I recently, at Half Price Books, it was the most bizarre thing in the world, found the collected Time Twisters. What the hell? This exists? Never would have imagined.
It's that. Alan Moore. Of course it exists.
Yeah, of course it exists. So just amazing, fun stuff. But those were the kind of little happy accents. But before, you know, even... that notwithstanding, before the internet would occasionally point you in the right direction.
Right.
To stumble on these things by design. There was there were a lot of comic book magazines back in the day. Because there was a time when magazines were relevant, because that's all we had.
Yeah, there were a lot of them, yeah.
Depending on who you ask about me, thank you. Anyone who's ever called me Grandpa Cole. But, you know, that was the thing. And I'm struggling to remember there was the name of it, but there was a giant-ass tabloid newspaper.
Yes.
That was, you know, a comic book newspaper. And it had, like, a few... it had the odd you know, feature articles, had some a lot of people writing for it, but most of it was just a giant ass ad rag. And comic shops and comic retailers from all over the nation, Midway, and even individuals trying to move stuff would advertise him.
That's the one with the seminal Midtown Comics. That's where they started their full page ad and everything, I believe. Just giant ads everywhere.
Again, you would occasionally have there were also a few recurring comic strips and stuff.
Yes, yes.
And like one of them was a character called Everett True, Comics Buyer's Guide.
Comics Buyer's Guide. Oh my god!
Got the name Everett True, who was like this portly guy in a bowler hat. I found, yes, it was a Comics Buyer's Guide, and apparently even in the Comics Journal. But the Comics Buyer's Guide was this gigantic newspaper. And I think later, they, you know, as the years went on to try to be competitive, they went to having color covers and some color pages and trying to be really slick. But it used to be just this big black and white newspaper.
Right.
And it ran, its heyday. Apparently, it went back all the way to the 70s.
Yeah.
But it was huge in the 80s, and that was the place where you found stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
Because they would always have their finger on the stuff that nobody was talking about or nobody was aware of. And that's where I found out about a lot of stuff. And then I think it was probably Amazing Heroes that did a special that was like literally, here's all the comics you ought to be reading that you're not.
Well, Comics Buyer's Guide was one of those things where because their business model was based on more advertising than any hack website that you could possibly find now.
Yeah, that's so true.
They had,
it was an ad rag, basically.
It was an ad rag. But what people were doing was sending, when if you made a comic book, if you made an ash can, if you were going to a convention, if you drew something on a napkin, and you could send a letter in the mail to Comics Buyer's Guide explaining what it was, Comics Buyer's Guide was going to put it in Comics Buyer's Guide because they needed content to support all this advertising that they were putting in there. So you could get into Comics Buyer's Guide. Obviously, if you were Marvel or if you were DC or if you were Dark Horse at the time or you know, you were Archie, whatever it might be, you were getting into Comics Buyer's Guide regardless. You had your spot. But there weren't a lot of places, if you were an independent comic creator trying to get a word out, that you could go and get that word out. Comics Buyer's Guide was one of those places.
Yeah.
And published up till 2013, I might add. So they fought the internet age for quite a while, yeah.
Dang, I didn't realize it was around that long. Because it got to the point where like the only place you could find it was maybe Borders, like every fifth issue.
Right, right. Or, oddly enough, at a comic shop.
Sometimes you could find it at comics. But I think one of the problems was it was such a gigantic... Nobody wanted to put it on their shelves because the format was colossal.
It was like, it was like a monthly phone book. And I'm not exaggerating.
It was like if you took Life magazine and added another Life magazine to it.
It was big. It was really big. I remember.
That's still published, isn't it?
How much was an issue?
Well, it was Secret Life of Walter Mitty was just a lie, right?
It's still around. Okay, they didn't cancel Time Magazine. You're good. But how much did an issue of Comics Buyer Guide cost?
That was probably like a couple of bucks, if anything. I think the costs were pretty low because they had like $1 billion in ad revenue a month,
right?
So they could afford to give the damn thing away.
But because I remember thinking, the one time I remember asking if they were for sale. Because the comic shops that I would always go into would have a copy of Comics Buyer's Guide on the counter.
Yeah.
And I only ever saw one copy in the entire place, mainly because any structure that you put more than one copy in would instantly implode and sink into Mole Man's lair. It would just break the structural integrity of whatever it was in. But I remember asking, and at the time, I was like, how much, can I get a copy of this? How much is this? And they were like, oh, no, like $350. I'm like, how is this $350? This is all of the information ever. How is this $350? Like, oh, well, they come out monthly. I'm like, how has this come out monthly?
Yeah.
Like, who is doing this? Who is printing this? This is insane. But yes, okay. So you were saying Amazing Heroes was another one.
Yeah, Amazing Heroes was a more of a comic book sized magazine.
Okay.
In fact, unless they did a special and it was just insanely thick, you could pretty much tend to, you know, slide your issue into a comic sleeve, into a comic bag, because it was, you know, it allowed for that. But the Comic Buyer's Guide, Amazing Heroes, was just chock full of features and FUD and stuff and things, and you know, there was just always so much going on in there because they had a lot of feature articles, and they did. It was a monthly magazine, but this particular feature wasn't always there monthly.
Mm-hmm.
But they did the silly covers,
mm-hmm.
and I think we've talked about that before on this very show. That I honestly believe in my heart, in my mind, in my soul that one of their silly covers was the inspiration for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, you were telling me about that.
Yeah, because they actually had, because at the time X-Men was king, Storm had inexplicably gone Mohawk, and everything right. in the world had gone ninja.
Right.
I mean, James Clavell had never done anything for ninjas the way comics had.
Right.
You know, he mentions them in passing in Shogun, but somewhere somebody decides that...
Frank Miller had a fever dream that came out of his fedora into his brain, his magical fedora.
And I think that, Daredevil was certainly... Damn it, I wish I was watching.
I can't be watching Daredevil right now.
But
we should just be watching Daredevil while we're recording the show.
I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah.
I had to work that out. But, you know, essentially, once the ninja revolution, as it were, hit, everything was coming up ninja.
Mm-hmm.
And this silly cover that they did was Teenage Mutant Ninjas with Mohawks.
Okay.
And next thing I know, within... But it wasn't instantaneous. It just seemed like maybe a year or so later, all of a sudden, there's this thing that's come out of nowhere called Teenage Mutant Ninja. Yeah. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And it's making quite the
stir.
Yeah. So well, I honestly think that because of the naming and the pacing and everything,
it's
just something that says that.
That. I look at Amazing Heroes, and I've seen a few issues. I wasn't as invested in it as I was like Comics Buyer's Guide. But I look at Amazing Heroes more as a not only a precursor but as a superior precursor to Wizard Magazine, because they did the monthly, you know, the monthly articles. They did the exposés. They did the silly covers. They did the artist roundups, and they did it all first.
They were also a very professional magazine.
Right. And they did it all better, I think, than Wizard. Because, again, we've said it before, we'll probably say it again on this show, you know, mouth open, insert image is essentially Wizard's motto, you know, at some point. Or whoever was, you know, buying their full spread ads all of a sudden had full write-ups on whatever books they were coming out that month.
Oh, absolutely. And it's little wonder that, you know, they were the sweetheart of Image, because Image provided so much content.
Oh.
And the cover feature for 95% of the entire print run. Their first issue features Spider-Man, and then after that, it's pretty much Image almost nonstop. Will Eisner, is he a thing? Let's do it.
Who's that? What?
We'll do one cover with him.
Yeah, they're definitely the TMZ of comic publications.
Oh, in so many ways.
Yeah.
I mean, if there was a way to, like, shove the magazine in someone's face while you published it.
I'm surprised they didn't have a show on, like, you know, on E! Entertainment or something. They didn't weasel their way into that market before they went down or after they went down. There's one more publication I'd like to talk about, and it was the publication that we all feared, and it was the Zardoz of publications. We all feared it and equally worshipped it, and that was the Overstreet Comic Book Price Guide. For any collector, this mandated our lives.
Oh yeah, the Overstreet. Speaking of phone books,
right?
The Overstreet Price Guide was a miniature phone book of its day.
And that's what we lived our lives by. If you were buying or selling comic books, if you were looking for a comic, you went through, because this is what all of the comic shops used to price their books before Wizard. And fucking Wizard. But
But in many ways it was as bad, or became as bad as what Wizard would be. Dr. Robert Overstreet, I think he was a doctor. But anyway, Robert Overstreet was the publisher and creator of Overstreet's Price Guide, or right. It was known in the day over the Overpriced Street Guide.
There you go. That's I was waiting on that.
Yes. And the thing about it is that the Overstreet Price Guide.
It's hard to say, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. Conceptually, what it was the resource for all things comics. I think there was a time when literally an Overstreet Price Guide had every single comic ever in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as the gluts began,
right,
that became untenable. And so, if you wanted to find the serial killings, for example, chances are, if you picked up a brand new Overstreet's in the last 10 years, it wouldn't have that in it.
No.
Because there simply isn't space. It's just the way it is. And that's
right.
Fine. But, yeah, the thing about it was that was your resource, and it was oftentimes the way you would, you know, you could tell, do I want to buy from a dealer at a comic shop? Because you're like, how much is this? And then go pull out the Overstreet's. Like, okay, thank you. Goodbye.
Yeah, right. And you're like, oh, I'm out.
If you can't make your own decisions, then that's too bad. So, but yeah, the Overstreet Price Guide, one of the problems was that back when the Captain America movie, not the ones we enjoy
the
today.
The Reb Brown conversion van bike.
No, the movie, the one that never really got a theatrical release, or got a very limited theatrical release.
Okay.
It's the... the one that had, like, the Italian Red Skull in it?
Yeah. And that's the Red Brown one, right?
Oh, did it have a conversion van? I was thinking of the... I never saw it. I was thinking of the TV show where he had the clear shield. And
no,
the,
it was the same. It was the same idea for the windshield.
Oh, okay.
But,
I did not realize that.
But he drove
except
across...
Except that he had a proper shield.
Yeah, he drove across the countryside of California in a conversion van that literally converted it, like had his bike hidden in it, like,
oh wow,
yeah.
It just gets more amazing.
I'll lend them to you if you'll watch them, because they are amazingly awful movies. Like,
oh, I
so
want
bad.
I want amazingly awful.
Okay.
I want to see this.
Okay,
so the thing about it is you know, when that movie was coming out, before anybody knew how bad it could be to have, like, you know, rubber ears on the outside of your rubber mask,
yeah,
they basically Overstreet Price Guide that year jacked the price of all things Captain America through the roof. And that's the point where people began to realize that this is not reality. This doesn't reflect anything.
Right.
Up to that point, Overstreet's the means by which Overstreet made determinations,
right,
was by having a massive pool of retailers.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that you gain information from retailers based on what they actually sell.
Supply and demand. That's
yeah. And then you, from that, you create averages,
mm-hmm,
that set a national price standard. But...
But
yeah, at the point where you start to engineer based on, you know, they're trying to like play the stock market,
mm-hmm,
or something,
mm-hmm,
and that's not what this is. And I think that that was a big wake up call to a lot of people, and Overstreet lost a lot of credibility. But everyone instantly forgot, and Wizard comes along, and well, we could talk about Wizard all day, but we're going to talk about really obscure comics that you used to find because you'd crack open the pages of an Overstreet. Like, what the hell is this
thing?
I've never heard of it.
Comic Buyer's Guide, Overstreet, amazing. And then all of a sudden you would be like, what is this? Because you were telling me about one issue, and I don't think we got to talk about it enough like 10 minutes ago.
Yes.
I think it was it Amazing Heroes? Which one was it?
I believe it was Amazing Heroes that did the special, because I seem to remember it being kind of comic book size, but thick as all hell, because it was you know, had a lot of ground to cover.
Right.
And it was basically just like a guide to all of these tons and tons of different comics. And it was just an alphabetical order listing of comics that their editors and writers, I guess, were recommending. And you got, you know, not only, oh, here's the name of a comic, you got, this is what this comic is.
Ah, that's so good.
And it generated, yeah, some sense of excitement about stuff you'd never heard of. And you actually start going out, you're looking for this in the quarter bins or the long boxes at conventions or at the comic shops, and hoping you can find this storyline that inspired someone to write about it. And it was just such a neat idea. And that's where, you know, I found out about things like in the Comics Buyer's Guide, the Steel Dragon Press.
Steel Dragon Press.
Yes, which published about all of three titles before they disappeared forever, were picking up an ambitious book by an underground cartoonist by the name of Reed Waller, who I've talked about his work way, way back when Steve and I talked about Dirty Books.
Dirty Books.
And that was a book called Omaha the Cat Dancer.
Omaha the Cat Dancer.
And there was a big ad from Steel Dragon Press for Omaha No. 1 that just simply had the logo to Omaha No. 1, Steel Dragon Press, coming in May or whatever. Well, that's, yeah. But luckily, someone had taken the time to write about the fact that this, you know, what looked like a dirty, funny animal book.
Yeah.
Actually had something to show for it.
Substantive inside of it.
Exactly. There was something going on here beyond just, you know, tits and ass and naked cat people. And dog people and cow people and stuff. And the thing about that it also plotted was Waller's his ability to actually convey the human form, which in those early issues was not as good as he would become.
Right.
In fact, someone once said of Reed Waller that no one draws the human form in repose better than Reed Waller. And when you see this, he's capable of not only conveying simple actions like walking and you know, all these little things that most artists take for granted, but also just, you know, the way the body is in
right.
a relaxed state. When someone's sitting in a chair, they're not just about to jump out of it. And it's one of the most natural looking artwork I've ever seen. And so I got very fascinated about this. Oddly enough, a local comic shop was carrying it at the time. They would, like, anything that was naughty, they would have like one copy out with everything but the cover or the title covered up.
They'd have that black like piece of
yeah,
paper.
Yeah, and then
in front
you would have to go and you know, say the code word and, you know, do the call sign, the countersign.
There's a briefcase involved, two keys.
Yeah, you had to do the thing like in Batman where you're like, you know, how do you stop a dog barking in July? Countersign, shoot him in June. And I kid you not, that is actually from an episode of Batman, and it was one of the funniest damn things.
That's a really good joke.
Yes, it is. It's such a...
Like, that's an actually good
joke. It's even better when you hear Cesar Romero give the countersign. Countersign. Shoot him in June.
Shoot him in June.
Yes. He had the wayward teenager saying, how do you stop a dog barking? And then, you know, Romero's brilliant performance, shoot him in June. So, I mean, you literally had to kind of, you know, do this sort of little thing. But and this is a topic for another day because, as it would turn out, being here in Texas, Texas would turn out to be the state in the whole issue of censorship and the and what I am saying is a topic for another day, the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, which we need to do a show
yes.
on,
yes,
have someone
we do.
From on the show. But Texas became notorious for being the state that prosecuted a comic shop owner for selling adult material to an adult.
Right, right.
What? In this sort of twisted logic that if they would sell this to an adult, they could sell it to anybody.
They could sell it to a goat.
That's tantamount somehow to having absolutely no checks and balances.
Right, because you're actually, you know, obeying the law. Therefore,
yeah. Yet at the same time, within a year, I was at a Walden Books or one of those bookstores in the mall that was still around, or maybe it was by then it was a Borders around here. And here was the complete works of Robert Crumb on an open table,
right? Like out on their where
you could see
table.
Buxom big ass naked women with their heads being removed, and not only was it nudity and blatant sex going on, but also bizarre shit because it was Robert Crumb,
right?
And do we see any prosecutor going after
Borders
or Barnes & Noble or any of those bookstores that had, art books and stuff on there on open shelves where any child could pick them up? And believe me, that pulled many of us through puberty. and why is this? Because little bitty this is an issue for another day, and we will talk about that. But that was a neat little thing because, I discovered that. I discovered Fish Police.
Right.
Through that. I discovered... or you would, prior to the internet, when people actually talked to each other,
yes,
you would, people would recommend things. And that's how I found out about Secret Doors.
Oh, Secret Doors.
Secret Doors.
There we go.
Is probably the most obscure title we'll talk about. From 1986, Secret Doors was a comic. Trying to find who wrote the damn thing. It was a parody. It was during the parody glut. We've talked about, I think, at times about the parody glut. The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles launched its own parody glut, but then everything was open season.
Right.
But Secret Doors was one of the best written parodies, probably amongst the most poorly drawn.
Yeah. Yeah. The art is rough.
He got away with it because it was so brilliantly written, and it was a brilliant parody of Marvel's Secret Wars, and that's exactly what we needed at that time.
It wasn't the hero that we wanted, but it was the hero that we deserved.
That's right. It was the parody we deserved. Marcus Lusk was the author. That's L-U-S-K, not T. And the Secret Doors was basically this intergalactic entity scooping up all the heroes and tossing them into a game show called Secret Doors.
Okay.
And it was hosted by this entity known as the Over Yonder.
So good.
And they're like, well, where are you from? Over there. Over Yonder.
Damn it. So bad.
It was just so bad it was good. But it was hilarious stuff. And, you had this, my absolute favorite, most memorable character is Badgerine. Because as we are juggernauts of segues tonight, that is a great segue into another obscure comic that I never personally read, but you couldn't help but have seen it back in the day. It was a comic called Badger.
Oh, Badger was – I read Badger. Badger was so good.
And I remember distinctly seeing the cover of Badger one time, and I think later seeing some of the panels reproduced, where for some inexplicable reason he was riding a bison.
Because they just didn't. They just didn't.
Just like riding around on a bison drinking beer, because that's what Badger does,
Well, Badger was definitely a takeoff of the kind of the lead into the opulent. I'm not going to call it a subtle parody, but it was subtle for comic book readers. Let's put it that way. It was a parody of the Lobo Wolverine.
Yes, very much. It was the anti-hero, hard drinking, hard two-fisted.
Yeah.
Fast-paced, live on the razor's edge, I don't care what anybody thinks, but got a heart of gold.
So they could get away with anything.
Got a heart of gold.
Right. They could get away with anything. See, for me...
Including, apparently, riding a bison while drinking.
Well, I mean, who doesn't these days? Is really the progenitor of inebriated bison riding, if you want to get technical. For me, I always found books... I went to a lot of conventions. So even as young as I could, they would be local conventions, almost like, swap meet type conventions. But I would go to conventions. And that's where I would find all of my obscure books. That's where I stumbled upon probably my favorite obscure book that really got me into non-mainstream titles, I would say. And that was Drew Hayes' seminal work, Poison Elves.
Huh.
for me, Poison Elves was it was mind blowing that this comic even existed. You know, because I didn't know what you know. In the you'd go to conventions and you'd walk around and you'd see. And I think I met Drew Hayes. I think I bought my first issue of Poison Elves from Drew Hayes' table at a convention.
Oh, wow.
And Drew Hayes was I got to meet him before his untimely demise. I got to meet him and talk to him maybe 6 or 7 times at different conventions. And he was always the most genial, nicest guy. He was one of those guys that will sit and talk to each person in line for 5-10 minutes, just, you know, just laughing and carrying on. But I remember being there, and I was walking by, and there was nobody at the table. And this is when you're in an artist's alley or you know, in the good old days when people would come and they would have their ash cans or whatever books they pressed themselves, you know, and they're fresh off the press when they would get there, and they would have them in, you know, boxes, and they would be pulling them out and putting them out. And I never bought any of those because I wasn't a comic snob, but I was definitely mainstream. And none of them jumped out at me because they were, you know, a lot of those books, as good as they could have been and as good as they probably were, in my mind at the time, were amateurish books. So I was like, oh, well, this isn't glossy enough for me. This isn't...
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of them just looked poor.
Yeah, and I'm sure, looking back now, knowing what I know, I probably missed the boat on a bunch of brilliant comic books, but at the time, I was young and dumb.
But you have to also understand that at the time there were so many. I mean, it's amazing that a lot of these comics ever got in front of anybody. You know, back in our Diamond days, Catherine and I worked with an artist whose name naturally escapes me, who was working on a book that was published for several months or maybe even years called Shot Loose.
Shot Loose, okay.
And I can find no evidence of it anywhere in the world. And it bothers me because I would love to reconnect with him, but I can't recall his name to save my life. And not only did I want him to be in my made-for-public-access cable superhero drama that I recently found the scripts for, Justice, but he agreed to play the character that I wrote for him.
Nice.
And I just would like people to be aware of things like Shot Loose that I couldn't even tell you what it was about. I just remember seeing it constantly for a long time.
But you know, this was almost steampunk before people were calling something steampunk.
Oh, that's true. You know, I hadn't thought about that, but that was very steampunk-esque.
Because it was almost Shadowrun-y in its modern technology meets magic. It was full of like elves that were assassins and soldiers and warriors, and kind of was based in a weird time period that was modern but not. Like, it was really, and it was polished. And it was, and the art was really good. It was a black and white comic, but everything was there. So this really, I have Drew Hayes and Poison Elves to thank for growing that that independent, for really allowing me to go, okay, there are good books out there. I should start picking some up and reading them. I should take a chance every once in a while. And later on, you know, down the line, you know, before his death, like, he's just. And the thing about these aren't corporate people. These are people trying to put out books and make a living doing it. So they're genial, they're nice, they're kind, they're fun, all by and large. So that was my foray in, and I found a lot of those things just going to conventions and looking at tables. Like, you know, in the heyday, you could go see the future, you know, setting up an 8x10. You know what I mean? You could go see the Bendis when he wasn't Bendis, or Jim Lee when he wasn't Jim Lee. Or my favorite story is there's another comic called Great Big Beef. And Great Big Beef was just this weird ass anthology book that this guy named Captain Kyle and an artist named Mike put together. And the first issues are like following the Snow White, like it but modern, and there's machine guns and it's weird. But then he went on to do like a weird kind of Bruce Campbell spy character, and one of the guys that did it, and I street teamed for that Great Big Beef for like a year at the local conventions, and one of the guys that did it that I got to hang out with, his name is Mike Bianco, and Mike went on to draw a lot of Marvel books. And so these are guys that went on to make it big that worked on these independent books and just did the grind, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, there was a – and the thing about it is there are the guys that, you know, have to go out there and just pound the pavement and go and go and go. And some of them you never, ever hear of again.
Yes.
Because I remember being for 20-some-odd years, Catherine and I were convention dealers.
Right.
And I remember being set up this one convention. I couldn't tell you where it was or when it was, because it all just sort of flows together, but it was a place we never were again. It was probably one of the conventions that was a precursor to the Dallas Fantasy Fair, one of their mini cons. And I remember there being like these guys from out of town, you know, from somewhere else, from the valley. They're from the valley. But they had on their wall this comic book called The Clock.
Okay.
And it had this fascinating cover with this, like, skeletal or Grim Reaper-esque character and kind of a clock motif. And they had a thing. They're asking me about this comic. So I'm fairly certain one or all of them had something to do.
Right.
Self-published book. And I've never, you know, that's another one. I've never found any anything really about it that, you know, if I go looking for things about it, it's usually, you know, some old Golden Age character called The Clock.
Right. You're like,
So maybe he's like, you know, somebody went around like clocking guys. You know, just...
The Haymaker. But,
you know, whoever these guys were, their comic was not a hit. But then there are guys whose comic isn't a hit, but they are.
Right.
And a case in point, Iron Man fans will certainly know the name Brian Denham.
Yes.
And those who follow comic book lore will certainly know that Brian Denham was at a comic convention and was discovered selling his own comic by Rob Liefeld, who hired him on the spot. I think Andy and I were talking a few days ago that was in the time when Rob Liefeld hired anyone who had a pencil in front of them.
Anyone who could draw feet was hired.
That's true. If you could draw actual feet, which defied him at every turn, he even went to a tutor trying to learn how to draw feet and could not. Apparently, the rest of the anatomy was just fine, but feet just all became like everyone was a satyr or a faun or something. But, yeah, so you had Rob Liefeld hiring this guy on the spot, as the story goes.
Right.
That was at a Dallas Fantasy Fair, where local, at the time, Dallas artist Brian Denham was trying to sell his comic book, My Name is Mud, a self-published book. I thought it was an interesting thing. You know, we got talking to him. We bought a couple of copies, and I actually to this day still have autographed copies of My Name is Mud. And I believe that being hired on the spot put My Name is Mud on eternal hiatus.
Yes, yes.
Because there was simply no reason to bother with your labor of love indie comic that you hope to sell half the print run if you were lucky. Like the folks from The Clock, presumably. And many, many years later at the failed FedCon USA, during its meltdown, I got a chance to actually interview Brian Denham for the VaderCast.
Oh, that's cool. Okay.
And as we sat down and were doing the interview, I paused a moment, looked at him, I said, "My name is Mud."
Oh.
And he just, like, nobody, but nobody remembers My Name is Mud.
Right.
And I think that, you know, he could not have been more impressed that someone would pull that out.
Right.
You know, he was, at that time, big Iron Man.
He was, yeah, he was the guy.
He was a giant with Iron Man. And to have someone say, not say, "Oh, what's coming up for Iron Man," but instead say, "Hey, I remember you when, and I remember your book, and it was a damn good book. It was a great read."
Right.
And so, you know, My Name is Mud. If you ever come across that, pull that out. It's a damn good book, and it's Brian Denham's first published, albeit self-published, work. I mean, you know, you can't get – the only place you can get more obscure than that is a little anthology book called Genre that I think maybe one person in the world other than myself and Frank Anderson and Chris Fulton own a copy. I would suspect it was a little self-published book. I just had to throw that in there. Where Catherine, Frank, and Chris Fulton and I all took part in the strange little experiment and seeing if it would be possible to self-publish a book. Or you can get really even more obscure and do the self-published anthology that was produced by a bunch of folks at Diamond Dallas known as Blame. Don't ask me why Blame, but I still have my contributor copy, so...
Very good.
Which had the first and only published appearance of Kid Tapeworm.
Oh, really? He made it in?
Yes, he made it in. That was going to be my contribution each month was Kid Tapeworm.
It's awesome. You know, my fear is, my fear is that in the current comic book climate, that, you know, because we have Image and we have all of these publishing houses now allowing and signing creator-owned content. So if you have a book and you have a good idea and somewhat of a name for yourself, they aren't hiring anybody off the street to do this. But if you're Kurt Busiek or Busiek or however you want to pronounce his name, or you have an idea for a crazy
warthog like anything George Perez wants to do, somebody will publish it.
Right.
May be complete rubbish, but they'll publish it.
If you're Ed Brubaker and you come with a crazy idea for a hard rockin' gorilla detective.
Oh, okay. I thought that was that guy that was the warden of some prison that was played in the movie.
But
by Robert Redford.
No.
Oh, that's Henry Brubaker.
Henry Brubaker. But you can get your book done, you know.
Yeah.
But my fear is that with all this out there, that the days of being able to discover an obscure book
That's so true, yeah.
That the internet age has ruined us for the magic that is...
But that's why we're here. We're coming here to rescue you from...
That's true.
From the internet age. And in fact... As part of that, one book I really want to talk about, because it was another of those accidental discoveries. We would go to the Dallas Fantasy Fairs, and especially their mini-cons, because there would always be this guy there that I probably talked about on the show in the past who would have – I mean, he like literally bought an entire island, and top and bottom of every single table, end-to-end, was long comic boxes.
Yeah.
Crammed full of comics. And – The purpose thereof was comic books that I think the most we ever paid was maybe 50 cents a book, if that, and the least we ever paid was something on the order of 7 or 8 cents a book.
Wow.
And we bought tons and tons and tons of books. And the way it worked out is that he'd be there, and he was the most bombastic. He'd be like, push him out, let's go, it's fun to buy, let's get a spending frenzy going.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's beat the heat, spend some cool cash. So we would just go and spend, I mean, your ass would be sore from mm-hmm. standing and rifling carefully through all of these books. And we would just go and cherry pick his cheap books. And he didn't really care. I mean, you'd bring him a stack of books, and you'd think, you had already equated, I'm going to spend about $20. $10. Okay. And that's how we amassed our comic collection to sell, oftentimes right across the aisle from it. And because we would go and cherry pick, but we often would pick some obscure titles that just struck our fancy, like Puma Blues. I still haven't figured out what the hell that was.
But it was there.
But it was fascinating. It had flying manta rays and cougars and shit. So
of course you're buying.
Yeah, Puma Blues were there and had nakedness. And there was a very obscure title back in the day called Heroes. And I'm not talking about the one that became the TV show or the comic that spawned.
Yeah.
Was spawned by the TV show. But it was a little black and white book with some really good. It was like almost like the guy was using everything was done in charcoal or something. It was
awesome.
Fascinating the style and the pencil work, because it seemed almost like it was penciled but never inked because it was charcoal.
Right.
But it was like it was weird because you have these couple of characters who were kind of like a chorus.
Okay.
And narrated the book and occasionally just sort of like, you know, lean into a panel and describe things. Like, you know, this is the shade of his former self or like a ghost. Who knows? And now on with the story. Okay. And then there was like, you know, a sex scene with a stretching guy and his girlfriend. And there's one bit where I swear you could see everything because you could. And but it was just, you know, one of the first really adult, you know, written to an adult audience type of books where it wasn't afraid to, you know, have people doing people things.
Right.
And then one of the most unusual books that we stumbled on was a book called Dead Face.
Dead Face.
And there was Dead Face. And there was something like about, you know, I think it was number two. Yeah, second issue of Dead Face may well have been the first one we came across. And we kept finding more. And we're like, oh, we got to get this. Because it's got this guy with a head a yard tall that's got 10 pairs of eyes. And he's like doing, you know, pistol fingers. And there's like gun blast or something coming out of his fingers. And it says, "The Eyeball Kid, he's got a bead on ya."
What?
It's from a company called Harrier Comics. It's probably long gone. But fast forward many years, and you will know who this is when I say the artist on this series was, and the creator, none other than Eddie Campbell.
Really?
Who would join forces with Alan Moore.
Yeah.
To create From Hell.
Wow.
So if you want to see practice for From Hell, look for Dead Face. And what Dead Face tells you is the story of what remains of the classic Greek pantheon.
Oh, this is your favorite. Yes.
And it is amazing story where you have Theseus and Bacchus and the Eyeball Kid, who is the son of, what was his name? Kelly's going to be so mad at me because, like, was it Argus? Yeah, I believe it was Argus, the hundred-eyed giant.
Yes.
Yes, it's the son of Argus, who has 10% of his father's ocular collection. I guess perhaps, you know, I think in classical tradition it was Argus and a human. You know, the gods would always have human pair up with the humans. So their offspring only has 10 sets, only has 20 eyes instead, or I guess he doesn't get 20% of his dad's eyes.
Yeah.
But, you know, instead of having the 100 eyes, he has, and he's not giant. But he becomes the Eyeball Kid, and he inadvertently steals the power of Zeus.
Oh, man.
And further inadvertently, in his panic, destroys 99% of the entire pantheon at the tail end. And in many ways, I think the idea is that's telling them why did the Greek gods go away?
Right.
Because the Eyeball Kid killed them all. Or they simply died off. And you have Theseus, who's now known as Joe Theseus, running around. And this whole crazy cast of characters and a couple of the, like, Hades' sons who are, you know, running around as the bad guys. And the Stygian leech and all these different intrigues. And meanwhile, you know, Bacchus is just trying to travel the world and get drunk.
Right, just have fun.
Yeah, and he's hanging out. I can't remember the other character's name, but his supporting character is this dead guy who basically was a late arrival when the entire Olympian thing went to hell, and essentially because all the dead of Hades just sort of were dispensed to the four winds. He was like a late arrival to the River Styx, and there was nowhere to go, so he's just sort of stuck being a dead guy who's still hanging around.
All right. We gotta close this up. Right. It's already been an hour, so.
Oh my God, yeah. So,
what are your final thoughts?
Replacement God, Castle Waiting.
just run down the litany.
Yeah, Flaming Carrot, which is the origin of the Mystery Men, albeit considerably different, because, for example, the Spleen got his powers from swimming in Love Canal, a very dated joke.
A very jaded reference. Thought,
yeah, nobody would get what that means. Nobody who hears this gets what that means beyond a certain age. The litany we could go on for days about, but I would say, you know, when you're going to the comic shop to pick up the latest comics,
right,
to get your pull list, take some time. If it's a comic shop worth its salt, and this is not to impugn comic shops that aren't doing this anymore, but, you know, really, if they're worth their salt, they've got some crap in there they don't think they're ever going to sell.
Right.
You know, they've got some stuff that would be in the quarter bin elsewhere. It may be in their quarter bin, but go dig around. Discover something from the 80s or the 90s that you've never heard of.
Because they made comic books then.
Yeah, proper comics. And, you know, go in and just stumble on something new, and you'll find some really amazing little gems hidden away out there that are far too numerous to talk about in one show, especially when we talked a lot about the other obscurity was the comic book magazines. And sometimes you can find those in back issues, and they're kind of fun, too. It's like reading, finding an old history book or something.
Right.
And now I feel ancient. So with that, I'm going to let you take us out of here, and we'll plug things up.
Well, like I was saying, don't let the current and it's not a glut, it's a great thing, because there's a lot of great books out there right now. Just an insane amount of awesome books written and created by awesome, you know, creators.
So Fish Police.
Don't let that get in the way of going out and checking out some quarter and 50 cent bins and just finding some really wild cards.
And let me tell you, one of the things I love is when I'm at conventions and I see people doing just that, pulling stuff out nobody's heard of.
Right. Right. Just, ooh. That's like Cole and I's favorite thing to do. We found that Evander Holyfield comic. God-awful. We love giving
granted,
people
a lot
that
of that
stuff.
Winds up in the short box for the live show, but...
But we're giving that to somebody else who's like, what the hell is this? Like, I'm going to treasure this forever because it's ridiculous. Like, that's the stuff that's amazing. But don't let that stop you from exploring and unearthing things for yourself that you didn't know existed. Because there's a ton of Havoc and Wolverine Meltdown was a graphic novel. It was a graphic novel. Batman Digital Future or Digital whatever that was, the first quote-unquote computer graphic.
Captain Canuck.
So all these books are out there for you to discover and read and figure out whether they're awful or not. Like,
Destroy your duck.
Go find them and read them. Let's plug it up. Go ahead,
right,
Cole.
That's we're naturally coming through you through the ideally not too terribly obscure as with titles like Nexus or
Nexus.
Or anything by Jaime Hernandez, or the inexplicably became obscure ElfQuest.
And that's a shame.
Yeah, that is a shame. There needs to be yet another revival of ElfQuest, or Cerebus the Aardvark. I'm sorry, I need to get going here. But you're coming to you through the auspices of the Jedi Cole universe at JediCole.com, also known as the place you'll hear about Black Diamond, or Shatter, or Ghost World, American Flag. You can write to us at jcumail@yahoo.com, or you can also learn about the New Humans, Shuriken. I'm terrible. Grimjack.
Paradox Press.
Titles.
Publisher of History of Violence and Road to Perdition, which I'm sure they picked up for a couple bucks a piece and then turned them into awesome movies.
Mike Grell's amazing... Saber.
Make sure you check out Lubicon on Facebook. Which might sound obscure to you now, but won't for long. There's some big news coming out there, and not to mention the fact that vendor apps are open.
Tyrant.
They're going to be at the art festival
Tyrant
in Lubbock
Comics
this weekend. They're going to be out at Star Comics for Free Comic Book Day. And Cole and I have a very big announcement right now about Free Comic Book Day. Cole, would you like to give the announcement about Free Comic Book Day?
I think we should. We should also mention that you can find out about more of these damn obscure comic books, but conventions of every stripe can be found at Convention Awareness Project Texas at cap-tx.info, where you won't find out about the disgustingly violent adult book Faust. Or Grendel. Or Nat-Rat, The Dark Gnat Returns.
The Dark Gnat, yes. Or Sam and Max.
Sam and Max, Freelance Police. Or Whodunit.
whodunit.
Or Miss Tree.
Miss Tree. God. Damn it.
But, yes, for Free Comic Book Day, which is, of course, May 2nd, worldwide, Stu, no, it's not stealing. It's free.
It's free.
But, yes, Free Comic Book Day. We will start our day at a galaxy called Dallas in Garland. Then Andy is going to break the conjoined twins that we are to head over to begin our appearance at Collected in Hearst, after which I will break free and join him there. There's a good chance I may make my way over to the new home of Red Pegasus Games and Comics, because damn, I want to see that new place. It looks amazing. And because I can't go to Celebration 7 this weekend, I'm going to make damn sure I make the most of
right
of what I can do. And but we're going to be essentially all over the map. Those of you who were in the DFW area over the last several years at conventions may remember Percala.
Yes.
Her amazing superhero presence as the feline hero who always lands on her feet. Left a tremendous mark. We have been without Percala for many, many years. She will actually be at a Galaxy Called Dallas on Free Comic Book Day. If you miss Per, be sure and come out to Galaxy Called Dallas. Get your free comics. See Percala. And be sure and get your pets spayed or neutered.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a show. Join us next week. We're going to talk about robots.
That's right. Techno comics.
Techno comics. God, I'm going to go now before I throw up out of my mouth and my butt. All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.